You're listening to DK Mac Sessions. Exclusive interview, actor producer Marshall Hilton.
Good afternoon, good evening, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Ken Artus, founder for DK Mag. Joining me this afternoon is actor slash producer Marshall Hilton. Mr. Hilton has over 40 plus film to his credits. He was a regular co-star on the number one rated Fox Kids show, Beetleborgs Metallics. He is also co-starred in the 3D animated action-adventure series The Living Corpse from Anchor Bay Films. He has also provided support in the fantasy sci-fi adventure drama Fate, and supporting in the vampire drama Teeth and Blood, and supporting in the horror thriller Bunnyman 2 from Anarch Entertainment. Anarch Hilton recent and or upcoming projects include Blood Angel, Astro, The Debt Collector, but today we are going to converse on Hilton's role as BD in the cryptozoological horror film Primal Rage. Thank you for joining me, Mr. Hilton.
Thank you for having me, sir. That was quite the intro.
I like to start off our interview by asking the interviewee a bit about themselves and origin story. If you could take a couple of minutes and share with the audiences your humble beginnings and to where you're at in your career right now.
Wow. Well, this could be a long podcast then. I'll try and cut it short. I'm a Southern California native. I was born in Long Beach, California. I've lived in the West Coast about 35, 40 miles north of Los Angeles pretty much most of my life, although I have traveled a lot. I've been in the entertainment business since I was a kid. Music was my first love, and film, and went through life doing both. Majored in theater and music in college for a number of years, and then kind of floated off and did other things and changed my major. Ended up in San Francisco working on an MBA, and ran into an acting teacher named Jean Shelton. She was from New York, part of the Playhouse West gang, Strasberg, all those guys. And she brought this New York sensibility of theater and how that worked to San Francisco. And I audited a class, and it just reminded me of all the things that I had done in college. And at that time I was 30. So I had experienced a lot of life experiences, and it just struck chord with me. So I figured I'd be moving back down to LA in the early 90s, and relocated back and started working, and just been kind of just doing things ever since, to be honest with you. You know, there's when you live in Los Angeles and you grow up here, so much of the industry is everywhere you go. You know, every restaurant you go to, there's a waiter with a headshot and a resume. You know a friend and his dad is a grip or a DP, or they work in the lighting packages. There's just so much of it around. So at some point in time, you're never really more than a headshot and a phone call away from somebody saying, "Hey, I'm working on a film. I got this thing." And it's just around you. If you keep your hat in the ring and you do work that's acceptable to some people, they'll hire you. So that's kind of where I'm at. And I've just been chipping away for a long time. I took a break from acting for about 6 years. I didn't touch a screenplay. I didn't watch a movie. When that television show Beetleborgs wrapped, I'd done 40, 50 episodes for a couple of years, and I was really burnt out. So I needed to refresh my tank and went off and did some music and did a little record label and produced some records and just did that whole run for a while until it was time to kind of get creative again. I've always been creative. I've always got something creative in front of me. And so with the acting, it just allows me to stay creative, stay busy, and just keep working. It's all about just working for me.
Oh, that's great. And I do admire the inspiration there to go back after such a long hiatus. I know that must have been quite challenging since you're already in the field and now you got to jump back in, let's say, like a fresh start again, all over again.
Yeah, it was really weird, you know. I pretty much wrapped it up right around 1999. I was done. I just said, I'm done. Fuck this. And I just needed to just air out. And so, you know, I went and started working out in the gym, shaved my head, started grinding with my music again, because that's something that I'd been doing ever since I was 7 years old. And just completely buried myself into that world for a while, learning the new digital recording technology, Pro Tools, and, you know, buying guitars and basses and amps and keyboards and synths and MPCs, and just built this studio out and just started grinding in music. And I lost myself there for a while, you know, and dealing with that, it kind of ran its course. You know, there were some things that were going on business-wise that I stopped, you know, I was kind of done. And so I had a friend of mine who's a photographer. I took a couple headshots, and it was kind of nerve-wracking a little bit, you know. I remember I contacted my agent that I had, and he had left the business. So you're kind of out there floating, kind of, it almost feels like you're starting over in a way, even though I had credits and I had a resume. And I remember getting a call to go in and read. I had submitted my headshot for something, and I got a call to go audition, and I got nervous. I was like, oh shit, you know, and I never used to get nervous.
Right.
And, it was completely new, and I went in and, here's how it's crazy. I went in to read for a character that was supposed to be Latino named Estevez, right? But I had my head shaved and I had dyed my goatee black. So I guess they figured that passed for Latino, but I have blue eyes. Go figure, right? So, you know, I go in and I do this thing, bagged the first audition I went on. I booked it after like 7 years. I'm like, wow, that was pretty easy, you know? And then, you know, couple weeks, months later, another one, bang, got that one, bang, got that one. And I rattled off like 15, 16 projects in a matter of like 2 years. I was just like, man, this isn't that hard, you know? And, you know, then the reality came and, you know, it got hard like it's supposed to be. But it was interesting coming back. My mind was fresh. I was excited. I actually, the feeling of being nervous felt really cool. That means that there was shit going on inside of me, and, you know, you're bubbling and you're thinking, and, you know, the fact that, you know, you had a reading coming up in a couple of days, all of a sudden there was a little bit more of a skip to my step. I was thinking about characters while I was driving around. I was working on the dialogue. My mind was running around, and, you know, you'd sit in a chair with your script and the stuff. And the next thing you know, it's been 2 hours. You know, and you're like, holy shit, it's like 11:30. I got to get going, you know, or noon, because your mind is just flying around in its imaginative place where you lose track of time. See, I love that kind of shit, you know, to get lost in something to where it just consumes you. It takes you over. And, you know, and then you do all that work and then you get to spit it out, you know. So that was exciting to feel like that. You know, and honestly, I don't feel like that a lot of the time anymore. You know, I'm older. I've been around, and sometimes this business can kind of beat you up a little bit. But every now and then you'll get a piece of material and you go, ooh, this is cool. You know, and then it just grabs you and it just, you know, shakes you around for a while. And that's the neat part of it. It's such a challenge that way.
Oh, absolutely. And I also read that nervousness is just another form of excitement. So you just got to tune your mind into thinking, I'm not nervous, I'm just excited. That's probably why you knocked off all these rows. It was just excitement.
Yeah, you know, there is a fine line between nervous. I think there's two types of nervous. There's the one that's totally fear-based nervousness. Are they going to like me? I shouldn't have worn these clothes. Am I going to remember that line? I got to do it this way. And, you know, I hope I get the part. I need the part. I got to pay my rent. There's that kind of nervous that's fear-based and need-based. And then there's a nervousness that's more of an excitement, you know, that's, you know, where you smile, but You know, you feel like you're ready to go. I remember I worked on a film a year or so ago called Astro, and we shot it in New Mexico. So I was in Roswell, New Mexico for about a month. And I had gotten there, I had the script for 6 months. And I had to keep putting that script away because I was working it so hard that I felt like I was getting flat and predictable because I just knew it inside and upside down and the other. And I'd really put a lot of, you know, preparation into it and memorization and really thinking about it. And there was a couple of times where we had a start date and then it got canceled. I was like, oh, fuck. All right. They're bumping it for another month. And so I'd put the script away because I didn't want it to be old when I did it, you know. And then, you know, that day came getting closer and then they bumped it again. So we got bumped a couple of times and I finally get there and I get there, you know, 2 or 3 days early to acclimate to New Mexico and get to know everybody because I don't like just showing up at day one and boom, right on the set. And, you know, that's kind of a weird deal. So I wanted to be kind of in it. And I remember when we first started the first couple of takes, I wasn't nervous, but I was so excited. I couldn't get words out of my mouth. My mouth felt like it was round and full of freaking pillows or something. I couldn't get the shit that I had been saying to myself for 6 to 8 months or whatever it was out of my mouth. And it was really weird, you know? And then, you know, I kind of, you know, mumbled a few things here and there. And, you know, once that was all over with, cause I was really excited to start working, you know, once that happened and, you know, I settled in and then everything was fine after that. So it's managing that excitement. I remember a long time ago, 15 years or something, it was a long time ago, but I'll never forget this. And there was this woman, this girl that they wanted me to do the scene with. And it was, you know, most auditions you don't do it with partners. It's just either you, the reader. Sometimes it's a partner thing, but that's usually later on in the process when they're trying to match up people after you've already made the cut.
Right.
But they
right.
had this, it was a first time in and, it was a brand new thing. And there was this girl, she was standing next to me. And there was these people across the table. I don't even remember how many, probably half a dozen, whatever. And I remember looking at her, just trying to, you know, get a sense of her. And I could see her jugular vein in her neck just going boom, 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 boom. And I was fascinated by it. And then I looked at her eyes real close and she was really beautiful and everything. And she was listening. He was talking to saying something to her and her eye was just twitching and her neck was going boom, boom. And that chick was pinned out. You know, she was like, whoa, you know, I mean, her level of nervousness was pretty striking, you know? I remember seeing that and I'm going, wow, you know, that's a level of nervousness where people are talking to you and all you hear is wah, 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 wah.
Exactly.
You don't even hear what they're saying. They're in their head. So, I mean, they're just exploding in their head, you know? You got to figure out a way to manage that, you know? And I think for me, I've just been doing it a long time and you reach this level where you understand the process, you know, you're going to walk into a room or whatever you're going to do and you're going to do your work. And once you get past that level of fear, I think what happens is once you get some credit, you get a little bit of successes and you know, every project is a battle, it's a mini battle. Every time you do something and you win some and you lose some. And after a while, they just all kind of blend together. It's whatever they were, you know? So you can kind of come into a room or into a situation where you're able to manipulate the environment rather than be at the mercy of it.
Very interesting. You know? Very interesting.
Yeah.
And for throughout your career, you have portrayed both the antagonist and the protagonist. And in your recent film, Primal Rage, you're portraying these semi-antagonists. What is the caliber that you put into portraying the antagonist, being that this is the type of character that needs more emphasis than the protagonist? You need the audience to really hate this guy's guts for his actions and his demeanor.
Did you say you hated my guts? Is that what you're saying?
Not me personally. I'm generally the audience will. He's not a nice guy, let me tell you.
Yeah, but he's not a complete jerk.
No, he's not.
I mean, he's not a complete jerk, but he is definitely a blowhard. You know, to be honest with you, it's a combination of the writing, the way that the words that he says, in the place that he says them, and to who he's saying them to. And you know, if you can pick up kind of a physical rhythm, like I kind of knew what it is that his purpose was. You know, he was going to be in the way of the hero. And you know, the way that he was always talking and preaching, like he was, you know, I got the feeling that this guy was, he never really talked to people one-on-one. He always talked to the group all at one time. Even if he was having a conversation with, somebody, the girl, you know, Ashley, he wasn't just talking to her. He had enough volume to where everybody could hear the conversation, because he always wanted to be that guy. You know, and so, you know, it depends on the writing. You know, you always know they're going to be a problem for somebody to handle. You know, his purpose in the story is to block, not to assist. You know, and every character you get is going to be either you're trying to get something from somebody, or the hero's trying to get somewhere, and every character that's going to come in his path is either going to be in his way and not help him, or they're going to help him. And you just have to figure that out. If he's not going to help him, then, you know that you're going to be an antagonist, per se. You know, this character, BD, was, like you said, kind of the anti-antagonist, because, you know, he's set up to be the guy that, you know, you don't know if he's really dangerous or not, you know. And then you find out very shortly after that there's something more ominous in the forest. It's much more dangerous than BD, my character, and his you know, perverted, you know, gang of miscreants, you know, which were wonderful guys to work with. They were perfect. It's the writing, you know, finding a rhythm. I know that when I was, as an actor, you know, we watch movies and we always, any artist is going to copy from another artist. That's what artistry is, you know, we watch, you know, a guitar player. I've been playing guitar forever, you know, and I've ripped off Eric Clapton's licks and Eddie Van Halen's licks and Booker's licks and BB King. You know, we all rip off licks and then we process them, and then they come out of us in a different form. Painters watch other painters and they like their work and their palette work, and then they kind of infuse that inspiration into their thing, and it comes out in a slightly different way, but it's similar. I had some constructs that kind of popped into my head when I was working on this character, a couple of them, but the one that really popped into my mind, if you're a fan of any of the older movies in the 80s, 90s, Patrick Swayze did a movie called Roadhouse.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Ben Gazzara played the big guy in the town with the cigar. You remember that guy?
Yes.
Okay. He was kind of the big fish in the little pond, a big blowhard. He was the narcissist. He was a little bit arrogant. He thought he owned that freaking town, and nobody was going to do anything in that town and come in and disrupt his little freaking world. Well, I kind of, and the way that his setup was, it kind of felt like my character was kind of the same. It's the big fish in a little pond. He had all of his minions. They were yes men, basically. Nobody challenged him. You know, and I figured, well, my character probably owned the liquor store, the theater, you know, hardware store. He had real estate. He was, you know, he was the guy, and those guys probably worked for him. They were employees, you know. So, you know, you start finding these archetypes in your head of things that you may have seen. And he was one that came to mind. I didn't model him after that, but the writer, Patrick McGee and Jay Lee, the director was Patrick. He also co-wrote it. When they originally, excuse me, were writing the story, the reason that, this is a little fun fact. There's a couple fun facts. My character's name is BD. Okay. Part of the visual inspiration of the movie was from the original, Rambo, First Blood. because of the forest and when they were chasing Rambo up into the world, you know, through the woods up in Canada, which it, you know, in the movie it was supposed to be, I guess, Washington or something. And they really liked Brian Dennehy's character. Well, they didn't have a name for my character yet, so they just wrote him as BD because Brian Dennehy had kind of inspired the nuance of that character.
Oh.
So that, and they never changed the name. They just started calling him BD. And I remember trying to ask Patrick, I was saying, dude, while we were shooting, I said, dude, what does BD stand for? You know, and he'd look at me and he'd get this little wry smile. He'd go, you'll figure it out. I go, get out of here. So for like a freaking month, I kept going, BD, what the hell, you know? And I couldn't figure it out for the life of me. And then one day, somebody said something about Rambo for his blood or something like that. And I kept thinking about it. And then, boom, it just came to me. And I go, I know. I walked up to him one day. I know what you did. It's Brian. He just smiled. He goes, God, it took you forever. I was like, what the hell, you know? So to get around, you know, back to the thing, antagonists are something that I don't know. They seem to fit me, you know. I mean, I don't kind of have the essence. If I was going to, the good guys that I've had a chance to play are usually good guys that are flawed. You know,
okay.
Good guys that a character that might have to do something bad for a greater good.
Okay.
Right. I'm not going to be, I just don't feel like they, you know, a good guy that's just, I mean, a truly good guy. They don't fit my face, my voice, my physical sensibilities, the way I move and walk and work in the world. You know, you're not going to see me driving a minivan, dropping off kids at school with a dog, you know, kissing the trophy wife and, you know, wearing a suit. I mean, the only time the characters I play, if they wear a suit, is because they're very wealthy. They're kind of super villains. I tend to go either very rural in my characters, their country, they're rural, they're salty, or they're super high end, you know, intelligent manipulators, villains that have that kind of that style, you know. There's not a lot in between for me, and it's usually an antagonist of some sorts. I don't know why, but I enjoy chasing around heroes and busting their balls all day long. I think it's fun.
Yeah, it is fun. It is, like I said, it seems to be more challenging for actors to really portray that role. And for you, it seems natural. And I have to relate to a comment that you have made previously, and you have stated, quote, I've always been attracted to the darker side of characters in life. I'm not a bouncing, smiling, happy guy, shaking hands and kissing babies. I mean, we're all different types of people, unquote. So everything that you just mentioned right now just was summed up in that one comment of how you really portrayed this antagonistic type characters.
It's true, you know. Some people... I mentioned this, and I've been doing a whole bunch of press for this film, and you know, interview after interview after interview, a lot of stuff. And you know, I think that, you know, actors, you know, we're people, we're human beings, and we come with a collection of experiences, and we bring those things to our work. And the more you can bring your history and your life, and the things that you experience on a visceral level, on an emotional level, gives you the ability to layer your stuff, you know, bring different nuances and layers to things. Some people come from wonderfully balanced, loving conditions, you know, and they're truly organically happy and content. And I admire those people, and I envy them at the same time. You know, my condition growing up and the things that I've been through in life and things are completely different than that. And I have I'm just a little darker, you know. I don't have that wonderful, joyous, life is fucking bitchin' and perfect, you know, thing in my head. I've always had to fight for everything, you know, because of a lot of different situations, too many to go in.
Of course.
But so I tend to be able to I'm able to go in and try and find some of that pain and deal with that pain in somewhat of by researching it through characters. Rather than going to see a therapist, I'd probably be a happier guy if I went and saw a therapist about it. But, you know, I don't want to necessarily, I found creating characters and acting to be somewhat like that. And I said, you know, why do I want to go and heal all my shit and get rid of it if I want to be an actor and be able to have access to it?
Right.
And sometimes when you're working on things that require you to go into very nasty, intimate, dark, hard, emotionally challenging places, when you hold that light up to it and you start looking at it and accessing those memories and those feelings and those places, there is a healing quality to it. I know that some things that I was able to use earlier, years ago, that brought up pain and brought up tragedy and betrayal and hurt and lack of love and whatever, those don't work anymore for me. Because you kind of heal yourself as you go through it.
Right.
You know, something that used to work for you, you know, like when your first dog passed away and you loved your dog immensely and it crushes your heart every time you think about it. And I do get a little bit misty when I think about that right now, but it's not as strong because I've used that dog so many times in my work. So it doesn't work as much. So, you know, and you might get a part that requires that from you. And so you go, you know, you have to start digging back into your world and into your brain and to your memories and find other things that were similar to that. And you go, oh my gosh, I completely forgot about that. And then you get to think about that and the people that were involved in that moment and where it happened and why it happened and blah, blah, blah. And you just continue to explore yourself. Continue to explore yourself. And so it's easier for me, because of my condition, to access those types of things and those types of feels and those characters and that feel. It's harder for me to play joy, to be really happy. It's sad to say it, I guess, in some instances, but you know, we're just not all happy, bouncy people shaking hands and kissing babies.
Well, you wouldn't have the success in these characters if you would be under therapy and a good guy. I'd tell you that. And for the film,
you do what you got to. You got to do what you got to do.
Of course, of course. And for the film Primal Rage, how did you get involved, and what really attracted you when you read the script on this cryptozoological horror film?
It's reversed. It's flipped. I had, you know, it generally, most of the work I get is either an offer from somebody or somebody sends me a script, because I've been working a long time and you develop this pool of people that you've worked with that continue to make films. They go, oh, Marshall would be great for that. And they call you, dude, I got a role for you. Okay, send it, you know, and it kind of works like that. Some of them are auditions, you know, because I still do audition. This was an audition. I had gotten a little, you know, call from my rep, and there was a little thing that, and they give a character breakdown, and, you know, you go in and do the work, and, you leave, and then you get a call. And I got a call. I actually got a call on my way back home after the meeting. I guess I must have smoked it. They said, Patrick wants to meet you at the studio. Okay. I hadn't even read the script. And I went out to his studio in the Valley out here in San Fernando Valley in Southern California. And, he slides open this, you know, he opens the door, it's a warehouse, you know, your metal door goes up. And the first thing I saw was the original creation of the, of Predator from the original molds. And then I saw the original creation from the Alien, and several versions of the Alien as well. Patrick had worked on some of those movies with these guys. Patrick's been doing this a long time. And then I was like, holy shit, those are amazing, right? And then we moved further into the room, and then it's just monsters hanging from the ceiling, staring down at you, on the walls, everywhere. And there's just all this creativity. He's got his crew of people working, and and he takes me into the room and he shows me this concept trailer, and then he takes me back out into the room into a corner, and there's this Bigfoot suit. And he was showing me, there was two bodies, there was three heads. He showed me the animatronics on it where the face would move, and then he flipped over one of the hands, and I was looking at the hands and feet, and he had fingerprints on the fingers and on the toes.
Yeah,
and I'm going, this guy is working on a level of detail that is fucking amazing. And I just looked at him and I said, I'm in. I didn't even read it. I'm in, it's done, you know, just where and when, you know? And then I got the script, you know, and I read it and it was cool. I got a feel for it, but without seeing what he was doing there, you know, I mean, that was it. That sold it to me. He's amazing. He's so good. Funny thing is that this is a trip is when I went to do the audition, there was him and the DP and a couple producers and producers, Bulldog. And, I love Bulldogs. he was sitting down at, you know, and I did the stuff and we talked just for a minute and I left. Right. And when he came to the door at the studio and he opened the door, I stepped back and went, holy shit, dude, you're freaking tall. Patrick's 6'10", right? He's 6'10". And I was like, oh my God, he goes, well, he's Bigfoot. Uh-huh. He's in the suit.
Oh, okay.
So he, you know, Patrick's been doing this a while and he figured, you know, rather than have to deal with the special effects guy, you know, and find one that's tall or whatever. And he's been doing it for such a long time. He just figured, you know, I'm the guy that has to do this. So the director was in the suit. So a lot of times when we'd be filming, if he had the suit on during the morning and he was doing the work, he didn't like to take the suit off once he put it on. So, he would direct you without the head, the back, and without the hands. And so, you know, you're talking about doing the scene and there's this dude with this big bald head and he's in this big furry suit, looks like a freaking football player, you know? And he's telling you, okay, go over there. And so it was interesting to have Bigfoot. And in some of the scenes, he just kept the head on. So, you know, you're standing there talking to Pat and he's towering over you at 6'10" in the suit. He's probably 7 feet. And he's looking down at you with his Bigfoot mask and his red eyes. He said, okay, Marshall, I need you to go over there. You know, and then he would say action, you know, and say in the suit and go, oh, you know, and it was really fun and comical in the beginning. We all kind of got used to it after that, but it was still a trip, you know? So yeah, he was the Bigfoot. So, you know, all of that visual stimulus when I walked into that room, and it was just, yeah, it was a done deal. And that was in at the end of 2014, because I shot my stuff with the hunters on our first trip up in 2015.
Whoa. Okay.
And then they wrapped it, and then they went back up and shot all of the stuff with the Native American culture, the characters, the sheriff and the witch. And they also, that little house that she lived in, they had built that in Southern California and trucked it back up. So they had to take all that little setup and set that up. So they shot that in 2016 during February at the same time, because they wanted the lighting to match. So the sun was rising and setting in the same place. And they were using footage because Patrick's been going up to that location. That movie was in pre-production for probably 10 years.
Whoa.
And Patrick, oh yeah, he was scouting. He was going up. He was doing plaster casts of the trees and then bringing those casts back down so he could make, you know, Oma's armor and camouflage, and he would paint it to make it look like bark. And he was going back and forth for a long time. So they actually had footage from probably 4 or 5 years of different things in that movie.
That's amazing. And before we started our interview, I emphasized that I'm a big aficionado of practical effects. I favor that 1,000% over CGI. And Primal Rage really excels on the practical effects aesthetic. And especially the one that really caught my eye was the dead body on the road. That it was so detailed and gory. It's like, okay, now I'm interested. Now I want to know what's going on in this forest.
Yeah, that kind of sets it up, you know. Patrick trained with Stan Winston.
Ah.
He went through the Winston School of Special Effects. He apprenticed with Stan for a number of years, and then he moved and he did some work with Rick Baker. Who, you know, Stan Winston was the pinnacle, the mantle of special effects guys all through the 70s and the 80s. And then Rick Baker kind of took over that mantle with the Planet of the Apes and doing all the things that he did. And Patrick worked with him as well. So he comes from a lineage of guys that are really gifted and really know their shit. And people that are in the special effects world, in, you know, that they know Patrick. They know Patrick. You know, Patrick doesn't get out there and, you know, fly his flag. You know, he's an artist. You know, he creates. And he doesn't really do a lot of that self-promotion type of shit. That's not his style. He does work that is comparable to anybody. And so in this film, because he's a practical effects artist, and practical effects artists right now, these days, the last number of years, have really been taking it on the chin because of CGI and digital technology.
Yeah.
Audiences have become accustomed to seeing stuff like Avatar and you know, the Transformers shit, the green screen and all the CGI stuff. It's amazing stuff on its own, okay? Yeah. It's fantastically done, but it's not the same.
No,
and so Patrick, like a lot of guys, like a lot of artists, are trying to figure out how to stay busy and do the thing that they truly love to do. And he, in order for him to do what he truly loved to do, he needed to make the movie impractical. And I would imagine any movie that he makes from now on will always be practical because that's his gig. Greg Nicotero is doing The Walking Dead.
Right.
Nicotero's been a practical guy for years. Him and Patrick know each other. They work together on things right now. Patrick's doing a lot of the Walking Dead attraction stuff for Universal, doing when they do Halloween and shit like that. You know, his crew's banging out a lot of stuff for him. So these guys, Nicotero, you know, he loves making zombies and destroying heads and blowing limbs off of shit. Well, now he's got a television show that he gets to do that shit every day, all day long, you know? So, you know, they have to stay busy and because of the way the world is as far as movies and effects and shit, in order to keep his craft alive and, you know, feed himself, he's got to make his movies. He's got to do practical. You know, he also does recreations. So, you know, somebody can, you know, say to him, you know, like John Landis just did a book, his recent book on him and his life in film and monsters and stuff. And on the cover of the book, there's a picture of a werewolf.
Uh-huh.
That's one of Patrick's creations.
Oh, okay.
Benicio del Toro. He loves monster movies. He makes monster movies and he's a big collector of pieces. And so he owns a bunch of Patrick's work. Guys will buy shit from him and commission him to do a recreation of, you know, the werewolf in London or whatever it is. And, you know, he'll do it, you know, and they'll pay him big money for those because he's so freaking good, you know? So, you know, the practical in this film is definitely front and center. Almost all of everything you see to a degree is all practical. There is a little bit of visual effects in the film that are very subtle that you would never hardly even be able to know because you just had to. The end, you know, has some of that if you watch the very end of the movie. And then some of the gunshot stuff, but for the most part, everything you see was real. All those guys, my hunters, they all had, he had all those guys come in a year before we actually started filming, and he did casts of them, their face, their body, up down to their torso. I saw those when I went there to his meeting. I walked in and there was, I remember catching out of the corner of my eye somebody's face, and I turned and I went, oh shit. And there was five of my guys on a table. They were all airbrushed. They had their eyes in. They were all done up. their lips and their eyebrows were like mink fur and their hair, and they were all in these pained expressions of how they were going to die. Right.
That's
and
creepy.
We already knew how everybody was going to die. So they all had these looks of anguish and horror on their faces, and they were all just looking off in weird directions, and they looked like freaking people.
Wow.
And I was just like, yeah. And I just, whoa, Jesus. And I mean, it totally took me off guard. You know what I mean? And with practical, you know, after you add in the sound effects and, you know, the blood and all that other kind of stuff, you know, there were some scenes that, you know, when you're an actor, you know what the gag is. So it's not horrifying. It's very technical. It's not
right.
Scary. You don't get freaked out by shit. You know, you just go, okay, you're going to chop this guy's head off and it's going to fly over there and the action cut. And like, okay, cool. That was awesome. All right. You know, and it's done. In
right.
A theater with the music and everything else, it's just like a horrifying event.
Right.
But I watched a couple of those guys. And one of them in particular, right in front of me, and even though it was a gag, it was hard to watch. It was definitely hard to watch.
I think so, I know, I mean, which one you're referring to. I think.
yeah, the guy that went to the dentist.
Oh, no. Okay, not that one. Okay. There was another one there that really caught my ass. Okay, that was very elaborate.
Oh, no. I mean, they're you know, this film, it's being kind of pushed out there as a horror movie. And it's really, in my eyes, it's not a horror movie. I think it's more of an action-adventure thriller with horror elements, right? Because there is a lot of action. There's adventure. There's falling off cliffs. There's falling into streams. There's hiking through the woods. There's run, and there's battles, and there's guns. And, you know, and there's carnage, because this incarnation of Bigfoot, it's not like anything that you've ever seen before.
Absolutely. Right.
Yeah. He is a hunter. He is intelligent. He's more of a missing link than he is a humanoid hominid beast that, you know, nibbles on flora and fauna and doesn't want to be found. You know, this guy is a warrior spirit, you know, and, with the Native American slant and, it's just completely, he's offering up a completely different version, a different paradigm of what Bigfoot is compared to anything else. And I haven't seen a lot of Bigfoot movies, I'll be honest with you. I haven't seen hardly any of them. I see clips here and there, but they seem to hide their Bigfoot. And I don't know if it's because the suit won't pay off, or the suit doesn't look good, or they choose to hide it. Patrick doesn't hide his. His is front and center.
Oh, that's one thing with Primal Rage. It definitely stands out. It doesn't seem generic. The characters are well structured. They are not stereotypical characters. And also, in comparison to, I mean, last year and the year before, there were so many Bigfoot movies that it seemed like you're watching the same film all over again. And the thing that really downgrades the value is the practical effects, and the suit is comical, or it's CGI, and it just destroys the whole film. Once the antagonistic character is revealed and you say, that's it, that's what these guys are running from, I'm turning this shit off. But with Primal Rage, it's totally different.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, you create something, you know, Patrick's had lived with this for 10 to 15 years in his head. He's wanted to do this movie for a long, long time. And when you create something and you throw it out into the world, some people are going to love it. Some people are going to hate it.
Right, of course.
He took it to a special, Bruce Davidson, is that his name? Yeah. Had a film festival in Chicago. And then it's been changed to the Syncropolis thing, I think. And they took it out there for a special one night in Chicago. And I was curious as to, you know, what thoughts were going to be on it. And you can hear people, you know, you can read what they say about things, and you go, okay, well, that person's full of shit. this guy's hating on it just because he's an angry dude. Some people that want to just kill after kill after kill that are bloodthirsty, you know, they bagged on a little bit because it didn't kill all through it all the time. They want the slash stuff. So people that are into that slasher nasty, the whole movie, they were kind of bagging on it. Some people didn't like the story. Some people thought the Native American stuff, you know, and you're going to, you can't please everybody.
Oh, that's true. You know? You can't.
You can't. But most of the people that I've talked with, they definitely say it's unique. You know, the Native American slant was definitely an interesting way to look at him, you know. And some people didn't like that, you know, and what are you going to do?
Exactly. What can you do? You can't please everybody, but just as long as the negativity is constructive and it's not based on people being douchebags on the internet, you know, yeah, you just take that negativity and say, oh, okay, he may be right or he may be wrong. May take it as, you know, take it as constructive criticism.
What's constructive about it? The movie's already done and you can't do anything about it.
Exactly.
So fuck you. You know? I mean, like I said, you know, there's a lot, people have a lot of courage when they can type shit behind
right.
the computer and you never have to stand in front of them.
That is absolutely correct. Right, right. Their tone would change.
They won't say anything to your face. I know that for a fact. I've had situations where, you know, people know me or whatever, and you meet them and they're, hey, what's going on? I love this, blah, 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 blah. But then you've heard, or, you know, through a roundabout that they think you're a jerk, you know, or whatever. people are fucked up, you know.
That is true.
You know, you got to take it with a grain of salt, you know. You get the most angry, you know, people will say negative stuff. And those are usually people that are coming from a place of envy.
Right. That is true.
You know, you can't, you know, whatever. But it'll be interesting to see how it goes. You know, this was such an enjoyable film to work on. And I've done, it's probably been closer to like 60, 65, 70 films, whatever, over 25, maybe 30 years or whatever. Because a lot of them are just, you never saw them and they just went away. This is one of the most enjoyable shoots, you know, and it was a small movie, you know, and I've said this in every interview, you know, it's not the size of the movie, it's the size of the heart in the movie.
Yeah, exactly.
And this movie had an amazing amount of heart and everybody was in it and everybody, I mean, it was challenging. There's no question about it, but everybody was just spot on and just completely in it. And it was an amazing, amazing film to work on. And I just really want it to do good for Patrick, you know, because he deserves it.
Of course.
He really does.
Excuse me. And we're nearing the end of the interview, but two more questions. One, what was the most challenging aspect of filming in such a rural area, especially when everything was challenging physically? You had to run, you had to jump, you had to do practically aerobics in this freaking jungle. What was the most challenging part in portraying a role?
The drive, 14-hour drive there and the 14-hour drive back.
Gosh.
That was it. Everything else was, you know, the two leads had most of the intense action. You know, our guys, it was basically all my hunters. A lot of those guys are sketch comedy actors.
I could tell.
And so, you know, when they're saying, okay, we need you to hike, you know, 200 yards over to that big tree. Which one? There's 500 trees over there. The one next to that rock. And the camera's along, right, you know, and he would say, okay, go. And there's no sound. So, you know, you're seeing us walk through the forest, but these guys are smashing jokes all day long, just rolling and rolling. And so it was just hilarious most of the time because these guys just, you know, you just push the on button and they're just jokes and just shit flying all over the place. It was hilarious. You know, somebody would slip and fall and everybody would laugh at him, you know, and say jokes or whatever. It was really enjoyable. You know, we didn't have that much heavy work. You know, yeah, it got kind of dicey there for a minute, you know, but it wasn't work at all. I mean, to be able to be blessed with, to be able to go onto a 1,200-acre reserve by ourselves, no humans, no trash, no noise. The only noise was the noise that we made. And walk under, you know, trees that are 1,000 years old and 250 feet tall, or, and, you know, 30 feet around, and moss and ferns and growth, and a lot of places we were walking that people just don't walk around, you know, possibly places that have never had a human foot on it before.
I mean, that's amazing.
It was fucking amazing, man. It was awesome. It was, they shot some of E.T. up there. They shot some of the Star Wars in that area up there. You know, the forest stuff.
Yes.
It's a private reserve about 40 miles outside of Crescent City. We had to take a van up every morning, about a half an hour away up into this area up there. And we just set up camp and shoot. It was awesome. It was awesome.
Cool. Congratulations for that. And after the filming, I'm assuming you had to do ADR work, right?
The sound guy, Jacob Varley, his name is Jacob Varley. He also was the drone operator that did some of those drone shots, you know, those high shots above, you know, when you're watching the car and all that kind of stuff. He was also the guy that did that. I did no ADR. I had to do nothing after that, which was amazing. Most films, you have to come back in because something got fucked up. You know?
Right.
But you know, most films that you're shooting, something that got fucked up is because a plane flew over or a car drove by or there was a siren and a police car goes, you know, it's usually some noise that's going on out in the world somewhere where you're shooting that's not isolated. We had nothing out there to get in our way of anything.
Oh, that's,
you know,
good.
I mean, it was stone quiet. The only thing you would hear is just the air moving through the trees.
Wow.
That's all you heard.
For me, that would be creepy and exciting at the same time.
Well, you know, if you're a city dweller and you're used to the din of city noise, always there's a level that's always going on, traffic, cars, whatever, you know. And if that's your comfort place, it would probably be a little bit uncomfortable to hear just nothing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But there was literally, it was just the only noise that was being made was the generator every now and then when they need to blow some smoke, you know, and that would shut off and it's just silent.
Amazing. You know,
and it was really crazy is we didn't see any birds, very little life like that up in those forests. You know, you see occasional deer, an elk would go by or whatever. And, you know, there are guys that, you know, it's bear country. So you never really know what's going to happen with that. But it was amazingly still, you know, really, really still.
I think I have a theory because of why that happened. You have a 7-foot Bigfoot walking around. I don't think any animal wants to be near that guy.
It was like being around a bear. You know, I mean, in his suit, he was close to 7 feet, you know. Yeah. It was quite the experience. And, you know, you'll be able to, what I strongly suggest is that, on the 27th, you'll have a theatrical release. It's a limited, nationwide, it's about 450 cities, I think. And it's going to be, either AMC, Regal Cinemas or Cinemark. And this is the kind of movie that you should see it in a theater. If you watched a screener on a computer or whatever, if you experience the movie in a theater, it's a different experience. It's big, it's thundering, and it's kind of where you need to see something that's filmed like this. It's expansive, the location, and then just the sound effects, and to see Bigfoot 20 feet high, you know, snarling down at you, ready to eat your face off. It's a whole different deal. In a theater. I highly recommend it. It's for just one night. And it'll also have a featurette involved with it. It'll have the making of, some behind-the-scenes footage, interviews with cast. So it's kind of like the movie and the behind-the-scenes at the same time.
Cool. And that went to my next question about when the film is going to release and so on and so forth. But please do share your social networking platforms if you have any that you favor and you wish to put out there for the audience.
Well, I'm on all of them, you know. We got the Instagram and the Facebook and the Twitter, and I got my website. It's just Marshall with one L, Marshall Hilton, like the hotel, .com, or Marshall Hilton at Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. You know, we're definitely, you know, smashing with this movie. So, you know, I'm sure that some of my actual friends, not my virtual friends, just like, dude, shut up already about this thing. Because, you know, I mean, we're just, you know, I've done what, you know, 50 interviews, you know, emails and radios. And I mean, I'm just, it's like all day long, and I'm just pounding shit out there for it. Cause, you know, I want to make sure that people get a chance to see it, on the theater night, and then, and it'll go to Europe afterwards and do a theatrical release in Europe. And then I'm sure they'll do a DVD and a Blu-ray with a whole bunch of shit on it, probably in another couple months, something like that.
Cool. Yeah, definitely looking forward to that. And I agree with you. This is a film not to be missed, and audiences may get the wrong impression. Another Bigfoot movie. No. Give this one a chance. This is totally different.
Well, you said you liked the Native American slant.
Oh, yeah. You see, I favor films that shed light on different ethnicities and have diversity in the cast. So seeing that Primal Rage didn't have that stereotypical themes, I was like, okay, that's plus. You know, it kept getting pluses for me in every aspect.
Yeah, it's a different take on it, you know, for sure. I don't know. It's a different slant, and it dealt with some of that mystical stuff and the spirituality of yeah, it's just a completely different take on it.
Absolutely. And thank you so much, Mr. Hilton, for all this rich information about your career, your origin story, the way you portray your roles, and of course, our focused conversation, Primal Rage. Thank you so much for all this information.
Thank you for having me, and I hope you enjoy it. And, you know, we got other films coming out here this year, so don't be afraid to reach out.